Before we jump into today's episode, I wanted to let you know about a powerful free resource for Lent. It's a devotional excerpt from Lent and Easter for Everyone by N.T. Wright, featuring daily scripture reflections for a week to guide you from the wilderness to the wonder of Easter. Whether you observe Lent every year or you're just exploring it for the first time, this short devotional will help you slow down and grow in wisdom this season. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now on to the show.
Hi, it's Gavin.
I'm Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're going to be returning to a subject we spent a bit of time on last year and in 2024 as well, which is the efforts to legalize assisted dying, also known as assisted suicide, in the United Kingdom, where we live, or specifically in England and Wales, I should say, not the whole of the UK, because it's a devolved issue. Should we just recap where we've got to so far with this bill? Because it's been a while since we last talked about it.
Yeah, it's very interesting because... when the House of Commons voted for this last year, I and many other people had regarded it as largely a fait accompli, that once the Commons had voted with a clear majority, that really our political system would mean that it would ultimately become law. But in fact, it's becoming much more complex and potentially... the entire legislation could run into the sands, couldn't it?
Yeah, it's really in the balance. And so we are going to have to explain a little bit about the British constitutional system and how bills become law. But just to remind people how we got here, so there has been a to and fro debate about assisted dying for many decades in the UK. But in 2024, it was clear that the current government was coming to the end of its life, and the kind of government in waiting, the Labour Party, the opposition, the leader Keir Starmer, who was interestingly was previously the director of public prosecution, so head of the kind of government's prosecution service, and so he was responsible for drawing up guidelines about to what extent the state should be prosecuting people who assist suicides, which is and remains a criminal offence. So it has some kind of background in this. Keir Starmer made it clear that he had no kind of fundamental personal objection to assisted suicide, but and said his government, if he became elected, would make time in Parliament, but they wouldn't introduce the bill themselves. It would have to be up to an individual MP from the backbenches to do that. And that's exactly what happened when an MP called Kim Leadbeater came top of an unusual institution in the British Parliament, which is the ballot for private members' bills.
So I think we should just flag up that this is one of the very interesting features of this whole debate, and that is that there's a very long-standing tradition in the UK, in the English Parliament in particular, that issues which are particularly sensitive and which particularly have religious connotations should not be debated according to the normal party system, and the party whips, so-called, those who ensure that MPs follow the government line or the opposition line, that they shouldn't be involved. Instead, these should be entirely free votes, and because of conscience. And that's something we'd like to come back to perhaps a bit later on, but just to flag up, it's a very interesting issue about why these particular categories are seen as not to be debated within the normal party system.
That's right. So, which can happen one of two ways. So you could either have the government introduces a bill, and the government is clearly in favour of this, but it says its own MPs are free to vote according to their conscience. Or less commonly, you can have what's known as a private member bill. So this is when an individual backbench MP from any party who's not part of the government is allowed to introduce their own bills. Now, these bills, the people who are allowed to do this are drawn by ballot. So the names come out of a hat. And if you're at the top, you are given a slot on a Friday normally to introduce your bill. 99.9% of private members' bills do not become law, primarily because to become law, you really need, after your initial Friday slot, the government who controls the timetable to kind of create space for Parliament to continue debating this. So most of the time, private members' bills are kind of talking shop for an issue to be raised, but they're not a serious way to legislate.
And it would be true to say that many of them are about relatively minor and issues to do with local constituents, wouldn't it?
Yes, very true. So because they're not a serious way of getting business done, if you're an MP and you know that, you know, you've got a particular bugbear, or your constituents have been in your ear about, you know, that level crossing and that's very dangerous, you might introduce a private member's bill on a campaign that's of a concern to you, and it's more of a PR move. You're not seriously expecting this bill to become law, but it gives you a certain amount of time in Parliament to stand up and have your say. And it's a way of signalling to the country and the party at large this is something you're passionate about. And so they can sometimes be incredibly niche topics, you know, that you might get nobbled by a particular tiny fringe campaign group that's very exercised about whether we are correctly registering cats' microchips or something like that, which is not something the government necessarily going to massively concern itself with. But unusually, this bill, the government made, because it had kind of tacit government support when Kim Leadbeater, this backbench Labour MP, completely unknown really, came top of the ballot. She said she would use her slot to introduce a bill to legalise assisted dying, and knew that the government would create space for this to be debated properly.
So historically, this is relevant because one very important private member's bill was the Abortion Act in 1967. So the original Abortion Act was introduced as a private member's bill by David Steele. And so there is historically, and I think it would be true to say probably the HFEA Act was also a private member's bill. We'd have to go back and look that up. But anyway, there is a historical precedent for really very significant medical ethics bills being introduced as private member bill.
Yes, I suppose you could argue it's almost like a double distancing from the normal party politics. Not only can we have the concept of the free vote, where MPs are free to vote according to their consciences, but also introducing it not via a government, by a minister, but from a private member in the backbenches, makes it even more clear that this is a kind of separate act that stands outside the traditional to and fro of Westminster party politics. So the Kim Leadbeater introduces her bill in the autumn of 2024. There is the first substantive debate is what's known as the second reading. That is in November, and it passes that after a lengthy debate, 330 to 275, so a majority of 55 votes.
So let's just pause a bit, because Kim Leadbeater herself is quite an interesting person. She's a relatively new MP, only came in 3 or 4 years ago, and she had previously no real history in being involved in assisted dying as an activist or in other medical ethics debates.
No, not that I'm aware of. She was a very, very low profile MP. The only reason I'd even heard her name before is because she was the sister of a previous MP called Joe Cox, who was tragically murdered by an far-right extremist during the Brexit debates in 2016. And then when Joe Cox's seat became available in 2021 for a by-election, Kim Leadbeater kind of emerged out of nowhere. to signal that she wanted to take up her sister's seat, and that kind of personal connection, despite her previous kind of lack of high profile, proved quite compelling. But then, yeah, for the 2 or 3 years after that, she was a very low profile opposition Labour backbench MP. I hadn't ever previously heard her name in connection with the very well established campaigning for assisted dying. I mean, what often happens is when MPs get top of the ballot, they either have their own bugbears, but often they might not. All the various campaign groups latch onto them and say, look, you've got this priceless window. Let me tell you why you should use it to make history, to introduce this bill or that bill. So it's quite common for the MPs who get top of the ballot to not necessarily go with their own issues, but kind of take on an issue that has been previously worked up by a campaign.
And it's pretty obvious, therefore, that she was, you know, influenced by particularly Dignity in Dying, which is the the major pro-euthanasia charity in the UK, and very much took on the Dignity in Dying agenda.
Yes, and Dignity in Dying have made numerous previous attempts to legislate. So the last time in the House of Commons, it was all the way back in 2015, when again, I think it was a private member's bill. At this time, it was defeated quite comprehensively in its second reading. But normally through the House of Lords, there's a kind of steady stream of members of the House of Lords, who we will discuss that institution in a bit, who have been introducing a kind of standard Dignity in Dying, have a kind of a standard approach they want to take on assisted dying. So it's a kind of 6 month terminally ill, all the classic features that has been introduced on numerous occasions, often by a peer called Lord Faulkner, but also by others. So I suspect behind the scenes, Kim Leadbeater was basically handed a bill by Dignity in Dying and their activists that was mostly kind of oven ready, to use a phrase.
Okay, so to carry on the story, the second reading was passed in the Commons with a significant majority of 55. It then goes to the committee stage, and the word on the block was that the committee stage was not going very well for those who were in favour of changing the law.
Yeah, so the committee stage is when a kind of subgroup of MPs are chosen, reflecting the kind of contours of the vote, so a majority but not exclusively pro people, and they then take testimony and evidence from a series of people, experts who want to kind of comment on the bill, and they go through it line by line and kind of scrutinize each clause. And that is the point where amendments can be introduced and made. And so there was a many months of discussion. And in particular, I think the reason it was perceived as not going very well for the kind of Leadbeater side was that there was a series of very eminent medical experts, you know, people like the head of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and others, who were expressing concerns about some of the wording of the bill and the lack of safeguards, and how it will engage with people who are mentally ill, suicidal ideation, all these issues. And from the outside, as someone who was kind of keeping an eye on this bit by bit, it seemed like some of the early enthusiasm for this bill as a kind of radical step forward, a liberal breakthrough, was ebbing away as people were starting to engage with the kind of messy reality of how to construct a euthanasia system that doesn't lead to coercion, abuse, and the wrong kinds of people killing themselves fundamentally.
Yeah, and not only were there medical voices, in particular, I think the Royal College of Psychiatrists produced an official statement saying that they were not in favour of the legislation, which is very unusual for a Royal College to come out quite so directly. But also there were several eminent judges who said this, you know, the idea that you're going to have a high court judge hearing every case is just ludicrous. There are potentially thousands of cases here. There's no way that the court system could cope with it all. And so they then put forward an amendment saying that we would have a panel including a lawyer and a psychiatrist and I think a social worker, rather than it going actually to a court hearing.
Yes. And it's interesting that, because the Leadbeater side had made huge play of the fact that this was the kind of most robust safeguards, you know, so not only do you need two independent doctors to sign off your request for suicide, for an assisted death, but he would then go to a high court judge, an unimpeachable paragon of fairness and neutrality who could probe into the circumstances. And it sounds good, but as you say, the reality was it's an absurd suggestion. There is no way near the capacity, nor are really high court judges prepared and trained for that kind of role. So it was amended to be a panel of experts, which are, speaking to someone who is opposed to assisted dying, I think that's actually a superior solution. But I think it was it kind of chips away at the idea that some of these world-beating safeguards were baked in, are already being stripped away. And the idea that this was a bill that had been, I think the sense go that this was a bill that had been rushed, despite Dignity in Dying having had this on the shelf for decades, when it hit the white heat of intense parliamentary scrutiny, it came to pieces, and there were other holes and other issues that weren't addressed. And there was a sense that perhaps it wasn't quite so well thought through as Kim Leadbeater was proposing.
So it then comes back to the Commons for a final vote. And again, there was a lot of interest as to whether some of the MPs who'd voted in favour at the second reading would have been so concerned about the issues raised at the committee stage that they would now vote against. And in fact, that does seem to be what happened. The majority was 55 for the second reading, and it was down to 23, I think, for the third reading. So there were clearly a significant number of MPs who changed their minds. But nonetheless, it passes the third reading still with a definite majority. It's not wafer thin. And so then it goes to the House of Lords in our system.
Yes. So this is where we have to get into the constitutionalness of it all. So in the British political system, there are two houses of parliament, and a bill must be passed by both houses before it can go to be signed into law by the king. And so once it had passed with this smaller majority of 23, the House of Commons, it is then sent on to the upper house, the House of Lords, where it has to go through the same stages, first reading, second reading, committee stage, third reading. And it has basically been since the summer of last year, 2025, been working its way through the Lords and is ground to a halt, some could say, in committee stage. So as you say, you and I think probably me and a lot of people assumed, once the real test is the third reading, if you can squeeze out a majority there, basically all bills that are passed by the House of Commons eventually become law. It is exceptionally rare for the House of Lords to try and block a bill that has been successfully passed by the Commons. But this appears to be perhaps what might be happening in the Lords.
So this is where we need our resident politics nerd to explain to us the relationship between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, because it certainly isn't within my wheelhouse.
Well, yes, thanks to my 2008 GCSE in government and politics. No, an A-level. I did an A-level, didn't I, in government and politics? There you go. I can tell you all about it. So the House of Lords and the House of Commons historically in the British system had equal powers, despite them having very different sources of authority. So the House of Commons is elected. The country is divided up into constituencies. Everyone elects one MP from each constituency to represent them. The House of Lords was historically the house of the aristocracy. So you literally had to be a lord. You had to have a title, an inherited title. But ever since the middle of the 20th century, that has been kind of whittled away. And now there are very few hereditary peers left. They're about to be the final few are about to be kicked out. And so the vast majority of the House of Lords are people who have been appointed to be members. And they can be appointed primarily by the government of the day, but they also, the opposition parties, get a few choices. And there is also an independent commission. So because of this tension between an elected body and unelected house, on the whole, the House of Lords tends to defer to the will of the Commons when they disagree on something. But technically speaking, if they wish to, they can put their foot down and refuse to pass a bill. And that leads to a kind of constitutional crisis. And there is, we can talk about it a bit later on, there is a special way the House of Commons can kind of override the House of Lords' veto, but it is very, very rarely used.
Now, I just want to check before we go further. You did actually pass your A level, and you didn't use ChatGPT, because here you are giving us all this wisdom.
How dare you? This was in the era before ChatGPT. This was in the distant past of the early 2000s, and I passed with an A grade, the highest possible grade. So I am a bona fides expert on British politics, allegedly. We spent many weeks batting over the bicameral legislature and its various complexities.
So, interestingly, of course, this is an issue for lots of legislatures around the world, isn't it? Wherever you have two or more chambers, then you are potentially have the problem of what do you do once there is complete disagreement, and how do you cope with the gridlock?
Yes, that's right. So it's a very common system to have what's known as a bicameral legislature. So that's when you have two houses. So, you know, in the United States, they have the House of Representatives and the Senate. You know, in France, they have the National Assembly and the Senate. It's a common structure. They're not uniform. There are some unicameral legislatures where there's just a single elected body. And in some systems, you might even have a third person who has to agree. So, you know, in the British system, once it has passed both houses of parliament, it becomes law by default. The king, by convention, always signs a bill into law. But that's not the case in other presidential systems. So in France or in the United States, the president has freedom within certain constraints to refuse. So you could even have a three-way gridlock between the two houses and the head of state. As you say, there are lots of ways of resolving this. The interesting thing about the UK system is that it took until 1911 before they actually introduced a kind of break glass in emergency. This is how to resolve gridlock. Previously, if the two houses couldn't agree, it's just called ping pong and a bill would bounce between them. You know, the House of Lords would change it this way and it would go back to the House of Commons and they would put back in the things the House of Lords took out and it would bounce between them. And eventually, if you get to the end of a parliamentary session and a bill hasn't passed, it lapses and you have to go back to the beginning again. But in 1911, the British system had one of these crises over a budget. The resolution was a very rarely used piece of legislation called the Parliament Act. And that basically gives the House of Lords the delaying powers. So if they reject an act that's been passed by the Commons, it then goes back to the Commons. The Commons can then pass it again. And if it comes back within a year, after a year is passed, the House of Lords is obliged to pass it. So all they can do if they really put their foot down is delay the passage of legislation by a year. But in reality, what the Lords does is almost always defer to the Commons. So there's a convention that if, for example, a political party stands in the election and puts in their manifesto, we are going to legislate for X, they win the election, they use their majority in the Commons to legislate for X, there is a convention that the House of Lords will never stand in that way, because that would be frustrating the clearly expressed elected will of the people. But that doesn't apply in this instance, because it was not in the Labour manifesto, and this is not a government bill at all. This is a private member's bill.
Yes. So, as you say, my understanding was that previously the Lords in the end would give way to the Commons, because otherwise it would create a constitutional crisis with unforeseeable consequences. But this, it is interesting in that in this particular case, because it's a private member's bill, maybe, there's clearly some very hardball politics going on in the Lords, so that they have created no less than 1,000 amendments, which means, of course, there is absolutely no way that the amendments can be debated within the limited time that has been made available. And so it becomes a kind of British version of the filibuster, doesn't it? By just packing the order paper with amendments, that the entire system grinds to a halt.
That's right. Yeah. So the filibuster is where people kind of talk on a bill, sometimes about nonsensical stuff, with the intention that preventing it from coming to a vote, because if you keep on talking, it never comes to a vote and then you run out of time. We don't really have the filibuster in the UK parliament system. It's not really allowed for in the rules, but you have what's known as wrecking amendment. So that's when people, rather than saying, we'll just vote against this bill, they say, we don't really have the votes. But if we just keep proposing amendments, particularly ones that, if implemented, would spoil the original purpose of the bill, and you have to debate them one by one by one, and we have to scrutinize, and we can just delay. If we get all the way till the end of this parliamentary session, which I believe is in May, then the bill will lapse for lack of time and we'll go right back to the beginning, and we're required to be started all over again as a private member's bill back in the Commons.
If you've ever wrestled with questions like who goes to hell or should Christians believe in evolution, you're not alone. That's why this month, when you support Premier Insight, we'll send you a digital booklet of N.T. Wright's most thought-provoking Q&A columns as our thank you for your gift. Your support keeps content like this podcast going and helps more people grow in wisdom through biblical truth. Give today and get your copy at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death.
Hi, it's Gavin.
I'm Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So, in other words, it does look as though there is a realistic possibility that this bill, having gone all this way and having had all this public debate and so much activity on both sides, could actually run into the sands by the end of, you know, by the summer. Mm. And in which case, it's just... I mean, I think there are a number of interesting things just to discuss there. I think one question is do the means justify the end? I mean, clearly what is happening here is that the democratic will of the House of Commons is being thwarted by clever politicking by opponents of the bill in the House of Lords. And whatever you feel about the means, and you could argue that this is really deliberately thwarting the democratic will of the Commons, nonetheless, is that justified? Because, you know, this is politics and they're playing politics. And if the end result is that this bill doesn't become law, you know, is it therefore justified to use these means? I think the other question to ask is what, if this is talked out, there's going to be huge outrage amongst a lot of MPs. I would guess a majority of MPs who voted for this after a lot of heart searching. And there will be huge outrage amongst the activists. And but they will not be able to immediately introduce a new bill because it was going to depend again on this bizarre system of the lottery. And whoever wins the lottery, and will an MP in the next session be prepared to introduce it? Or could it be reintroduced in the Lords?
It could. It could, in theory, be started in the Lords. It's quite rare for bills that start in the Lords to make their way into law. But then you could say the same thing about private members' bills. I think it raises a really interesting question about ends and means. And if you are someone who is a kind of convinced opponent of assisted dying and believes that it would be a disaster if it came into law, you then have to say, you know, what is your higher priority? Preventing the harm that you believe assisted dying would cause, or upholding the democratic system, which says the people, through their elected representatives, have the right to implement whatever laws they deem fit. And, you know, as a Christian, you have to sit back and say, what is my higher calling? What is my priority? protecting vulnerable people from an assisted death that may not be their true wish, or protecting the integrity of our elected democratic system of government, which gives the people of this country the right to control their own destiny, rather than it being in the hands of some, you know, backroom deal makers in the House of Lords. And I think people of good faith could come down on either side of that debate about what is a higher value, a higher priority. Where is the more harm caused by frustrating this with some underhand means, or by standing back and allowing a deeply unethical law go onto the statute books forevermore?
Yeah, it is very interesting. And I, you know, find myself quite conflicted about this. I think if it was a less consequential issue, I think I would naturally go in favour of protecting democracy and democratic process, because there's, and we've talked about it previously, haven't we, in this podcast, that this whole concept that democratic systems are under enormous threat across the world, and you know, the rise of populist politics, the effects of technology, social media, deep fakes, you name it, democratic systems are under enormous threat. And therefore, you could say that being a good citizen as a Christian and seeking the good of the system in which you've been placed, our Christian calling is to support democratic institutions, even though sometimes those democratic institutions will make decisions that we do not personally agree with. Having said that, I think this particular issue, and maybe I've got special pleading here because it's an issue I've been concerned about for more than 25 years, and I do genuinely believe that this would have catastrophic consequences for the UK, for the NHS, for Christian medics and health professionals. I think I am probably persuaded that the means do justify the ends in this particular case, although I do it with a somewhat heavy heart.
Yeah, I also feel quite conflicted about it. I think I don't think you have to make democracy a kind of idol and say it's not an absolute Christian value. Obviously, you know, it's been developed in cities and states in ancient Greece that had no Christian heritage originally. But the reason I am a Christian and a Democrat is not because I think democracy is kind of, you know, instituted in scripture or, you know, how heaven is going to be run, but because I think it is the form of government which leads to the greatest amount of human flourishing, and which time and time again it creates societies in which human beings are free to worship God and free to build his kingdom here on earth as much as possible in the greatest way. So it's not an absolute value, but at the same time, I think you have to ask the question, how would we feel if there was an issue close to our heart that we thought was an issue of justice that had passed our democratically elected House of Commons only for some shady figures in the House of Lords to run it out of time? We would be outraged, justifiably so. And so I think you have to step into the shoes of people and say, even if I think the dignity and dying lot are colossally misguided, catastrophically misguided, can I have my cake and eat it? What's goose sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander. And if I would I be prepared to have this weapon used against us in a later debate? That's what would be hanging on my mind. What precedents are we setting here? What risks are we setting for Christians down the line if critical reforms can be undemocratically destroyed in this way?
Yeah, and I think it's a really interesting and challenging issue. And I'd be very interested in, you know, if anybody who's listening to this podcast wanted to give their perspective and opinion, it'd be interesting to hear other people on this, because it's in my experience, quite a novel and interesting debate to have this. I think the other thing that I'd like to just to discuss is this concept of the conscience vote, which clearly has been accepted within the British system. Way back, I think, this whole tradition of private members' bills, and also of the conscience vote not being subject to party discipline and party pressure is clearly a very significant part of the British unwritten constitution. It'd be interesting to know, you know, why is that? How important is it? And where does it come from?
Because I don't think it's an obvious feature. I mean, I don't know. I'd love to know whether it exists in other democracies, particularly the ones that haven't kind of developed along Westminster lines, that parties who wield so much power over their individual MPs and, you know, use a lot of threats and bullying and even, you know, outright coercion to force MPs to vote according to the way the government wants them to go, the way the party bosses want them to go, even, you know, and there's endless stories of MPs who, after they retire, kind of when it's safe, let reveal that, you know, they really strongly disagreed with principle X or issue A, but were basically forced by their party whips to toe the line. And yet suddenly there is widespread consensus across the British political system that these issues, sometimes called ethical issues, moral issues, so your issues around divorce, gay marriage, abortion, sister dying, these some are just taken for granted to stand outside of the kind of the muck and the to and fro of Westminster party politics, and it would be wrong to force people to vote against the convictions.
So one of the very interesting things I would like to know, whether your A-level extended to, is what happens in France, because France, of course, has a political system which was intentionally entirely secular. You know, the religious protection was effectively removed, in my understanding, in French politics, and it still has this very strong sense of secularity. And it'd be interesting to know, is there any conscience protection within the French constitutional system?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I'll be honest, off the top of my head, my A-level politics did not extend to the minutiae of French parliamentary procedure, so I don't know the answer. I think it is certainly hard to imagine this conscience-free vote kind of provision becoming an established, unchallengeable feature of British political life without the impact of Christendom. And in particular, I think the Reformation and kind of Protestantism, which almost reified the individual conscience. You know, it struck away the mediators and the kind of institutions and the magisterium of the church and said each Christian must stand before his God and answer for his acts. And he has to, you know, use his God-given reason and holy scripture and come to his own conclusions. And I think there is a sense in which even the might of the British political parties must tremble, you know, before the even higher authority of the Almighty. And people don't really phrase it anymore because we have a mostly, you know, secular parliament of mostly atheists. But I think it fundamentally derives from the same idea that people, to compel someone to act against their conscience is a kind of grave moral sin, a moral injury that we, on some issues, it's too much to ask parliamentarians to go against their deeply held conscience convictions.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fascinating phenomenon, actually, which you know, hasn't had enough discussion, really, because one of the things that I've been told in discussion about very complex medical legal cases is that no British judge would instruct a doctor to do something such as to, you know, give a treatment or to switch off a life support system if the doctor said, this is against my conscience. The judge would not use their power, their state power, to force a doctor to do something against their conscience. And where there have been occasional cases where the judge has decided a case and said it would be right, for instance, to switch off the life support system, and the doctor has said to the judge, I cannot do this, my lord, this would be against my conscience, the judge has effectively instructed, well, then you should try to find another doctor who would be prepared to do it, rather than say, you know, I am the representative of the law and you must do what I tell you. So in other words, it is interesting, isn't it? There is a deeply rooted respect within our common law system for the conscience of individuals, and as you say, the idea is that there is a, we are under a higher authority. Yes, there is the authority of the king. Yes, there is the authority of the state, but actually, there's a higher authority, and ultimately, each of us must do what we feel is correct. I mean, it's a very Christian principle, and you're right; it's a Protestant principle, I think. That would put the individual right of conscience rather against the, you know, what the Pope says, or, you know, what a denominational chief says.
And because we live in an era post Enlightenment of, you know, rational individualism, it feels obvious, but we shouldn't underestimate when this idea was first emerging, it is profoundly radical, because the society in which the Reformation happened were societies in which everyone lived under a lord or a master. Everyone owed fealty to someone. Everyone was subordinated to an institution. If you were a priest, you owed it ultimately to the Pope, but if you were a commoner, it was to your lord and ultimately to the king. And the idea that you had a higher calling, a higher authority, could trump your, you know, and that in these atomized individuals could step out of the mass of society and act individually is a profoundly radical idea, which has laid the basis for, you know, the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, contemporary democratic liberal politics, all the way to our societies, potentially even secularism itself. It is a long way downstream from quite a fundamental Christian idea that I think we sometimes struggle to see how radical it is, because it is the very water that we're swimming in.
But having said that, the individual right of conscience is now under enormous threat, and there are, you know, very influential voices within medicine saying we can no longer tolerate doctors who are claiming the right of conscience. If they wish to practice medicine in the 21st century, particularly if they wish to practice medicine within a state health funded health system, then they must agree to do whatever is legal. Okay, they can refuse to do anything that's illegal, but if it is legal, if a procedure is legal, they do not have the right just to say, well, my precious conscience says I can't do this, because our first priority is to make sure that the system runs smoothly. We want to maximize output. We want to ensure the smooth bureaucratic running, and doctors who can at any moment claim the right of individual conscience are causing immense logistical problems.
And this is again part of a bigger process in which doctors are kind of being transformed from independent critical physicians to kind of cogs in a healthcare machine. You know, and then once upon a time, many, many moons ago, the kind of doctor was the source of authority, and the physician was supposed to use their intellect and their experience to come to their own independent decision on treatment. Whereas now there are guidelines and protocols and bureaucracies you have to answer to. And, oh, why did you don't just treat Mrs. X the way you think Mrs. X should be treated. You follow the guidelines that your NHS trust has laid down, and it's been fully evidenced by NICE and all this. And so the idea of the doctor as an independent locus of authority is already eroded. They're just a delivery of healthcare services, a cog in the machine. And so, as you say, it makes no sense that they should have the right to opt out, use their own, not even their medical beliefs, but their personal, private, moral and religious convictions. Why should that interfere with the proper running of the protocol that's been agreed by the committee at the highest stage, et cetera, et cetera?
Absolutely right. And yet I and many other Christian doctors have made the argument, and, you know, I've written about this, and we can link up in the show notes, that actually to force any human being by state power and state authority to say you must do something which you find deeply and morally abhorrent, but I am going to force you because we have to use state power to force individuals to do things which they find deeply repugnant and morally abhorrent, is an abuse of power. And I have adopted the phrase that this is a rape of the heart, and the state should not rape people. It should not coerce and abuse individuals. Now, of course, we're not talking about trivial things. I think sometimes the right of conscience, I'm afraid, is used, including by doctors, just to get out of trivial inconveniences, and that's quite wrong. But when we are dealing with profoundly important things to do with killing, or with, you know, with fundamental Christian values, then I support the right of conscience. And basically, we accept that it's not something that we can enforce the right of conscience. It's a gift, a gracious gift from the rest of society, because if I refuse to do a procedure, that means somebody else is going to have to, you know, the NHS is going to have to find another doctor to do the procedure. And so I'm creating, yes, I accept I'm creating difficulties, but I'm asking my colleagues, I'm asking the managers to give me the right, because this is the way we run as for social cohesion. This is necessary in a pluralistic society.
But what about the argument that, you know, that argument holds steady when you talk about something like conscription in wartime? And again, it'd be interesting to note, you know, the rise of the concept of the kind of conscientious objector. But that's different because no one has the choice, right? If conscription, you literally, by definition, you haven't volunteered. You've been told by the government you must take up a gun and go and kill people. And so we say for those for whom that breaches their conscience, we will provide other ways they can serve that don't involve killing, taking life. But no one is conscripting you to be a doctor. Or let's use another example. You know, if you have a conscientious objection to gay marriage and no one makes you go and sign up to be a council registrar who in the UK system kind of officiates at civil weddings. So in that sense, could you not argue the government has every right to insist that its employees carry out its instructions according to the law? And if that is difficult for you, then you are at total liberty to resign your post and find another employment which does not contradict your conscience.
Yeah, we've gone slightly off the point here, but nonetheless, it's an interesting conversation. So interestingly, I think if you take certain minority religious beliefs, and the most obvious one here I would point to are Jehovah's Witnesses, who have very strong beliefs about the use of blood products and blood transfusion. Would it be possible for a convinced Jehovah's Witness to act as a doctor, to be qualified as a doctor and work within the NHS? And the short answer is no. It's simply not possible. Because if every time a patient needs a blood transfusion and you say, well, I'm sorry, I've got a conscience, you know, here's the patient bleeding to death in A&E, but I really, you know, I can't do anything about it. Sorry. You know, it just doesn't work. You can't, you know, because so there are some minority religious beliefs which are incompatible with working as a doctor, at least in the NHS. But when it comes to killing, I mean, my argument is that killing people has never been part of medicine. In fact, the Hippocratic Oath, you know, for 2,000 years and more, doctors have taken a solemn oath never to use their medical skills to hurt or to harm their patients. If you now redefine all of a sudden, you know, in 2025, you redefine medicine, you say, oh, we've changed our minds, you know, now doctors, yeah, of course, killing, what's the problem? This is at such a fundamental level to then say, oh, so I'm sorry, no longer, you know, can we take any doctors who believe that life is precious and life is sacrosanct? I'm sorry, those kind of people no longer, you know, we can't have any of those in the medical profession. You know, what are you doing to the medical profession? Does the great British public wish their friendly doctors now only to be people who are also active killers? I put it in very stark terms, but you can see the point. So yeah. I think I would argue very strongly that those who wish to withdraw the right of conscience will lead inevitably to a very different kind of medical profession.
Yes.
So interestingly, therefore, you know, the purveyors of this bill have retained the right of conscience for individual doctors, but what they have said is that a doctor cannot completely opt out of the system, even if they feel it's against their conscience. The doctor must be prepared at least to discuss the possibility of assisted dying with a patient and to refer them to another doctor if the patient is eligible for the process.
Yes, and I remember just briefly when we discussed Canada's system known as medical assistance in dying, that was again one of the kind of key points of debate, is to what extent should, because it's done on kind of province by province basis there, to what extent should Christian doctors have the right to opt out, and in addition should they have the right to refuse to refer on and say, not only will I not carry out your death, I won't even, you know, give you a referral to a doctor who will, because that contradicts my own conscience and my own desire to be as, you know, as morally removed from the act as possible. And again, there are differences of opinions within Christians and within doctors about whether the right of conscience should extend to a refusal to refer as well. So we should probably bring this to an end. Where have we got to? So, you know, in the House of Lords, these 1,000+ amendments are still being worked through. The government has agreed to set aside some more time in the parliamentary timetable in an effort to try and get through the committee stage before the clock runs out of time at the end of this parliamentary session. But it, you know, remains to be seen if it's feasible to work through that number of amendments. Of course, those who put them up insist that they are not cynical wrecking amendments. They are, you know, genuine attempts to try and fix the bill to make it less vulnerable to abuse and coercion. Whether you believe them is entirely up to you. But we will have to keep an eye on how that unfolds in the coming months.
Yes, and I do think this is an interesting moral dilemma about what it means to be a good citizen when your government is proposing, or when your constitutional system is proposing doing things which you find deeply concerning and worrying. And I think balancing these kind of grey areas, this is the you know, the real business of morality in a broken and fallen world, you know, and people come to different conclusions. But in the end, it is a matter of conscience. It's a matter of what I believe is right. I mean, in reality, these things are above our pay grade, aren't they? I mean, our individual decisions are not going to make any difference. The system is operating, you know, outside our own individual influence, but nonetheless, it's fascinating debate to see how it unfolds in the next few weeks and months.
Mm. Fundamentally, it's another question, as so often it ends in this podcast, with how do we choose between the lesser of two evils? You know, so how many of the ethical debates we talk about, you know, germline editing and whatever else, ultimately there isn't a clear, obvious good solution, bad solution, but we're trying to work our way through the murk of the lesser of two evils. And I think this discussion about you know, the progress of the assisted dying bill is, again, Christians should choose between the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, to be honest, it's often formulated in that way. I've always had a visceral dislike of that formulation, the lesser of two evils. And the reason is I find it so difficult to think of Jesus of Nazareth sort of recommending the lesser of two evils. I think a better way of formulating it is what is the good? You know, how do we promote the good? And here there are two goods. There is the good of preserving democratic process, and there is the good of protecting vulnerable people from horrendously dangerous legislation. And our difficulty is choosing between goods, I think. I think it's choosing which is the greater good, which we will vote for. I just think that's a better way of thinking about it rather than the lesser of two evils.
Maybe there's another podcast in all that discussion for another time. Thanks, everyone, for listening. As Dad said earlier, we'd be really curious to know your own take on this particular dilemma and on the assisted dying issue in general. You know, do you think it is only right for opponents of assisted dying to get down in the dirt and fight dirty to try and stop this bill coming into law, including using all the odd quirks and eccentricities of the British Constitution to do so? Or should we retire gracefully admit defeat and move on to trying to think about how we live well in a world that has already allowed assisted dying, as frankly is the case for many hundreds of millions of doctors and believers in other jurisdictions which have had assisted dying laws on the books for some time now. We'd love to know your view. Please get in touch with us, MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. That's the email address. We read every email that comes in and respond to them all as well. And a lot of them form the basis of episodes of this podcast. So please do keep those emails coming in. There's also tons and tons on Dad's website about assisted dying and euthanasia. Lots of his talks and books and articles and podcasts. If you go to johnwyatt.com, J-O-H-N-W-Y-A-T-T, you can find that all there. And you can find some of my journalism, which occasionally intersects with my government and politics A-level, but not very often. It's more often about the church affairs. You can find some of my journalism on my website. That's tswyatt.com. And in particular, please do sign up to my weekly Substack newsletter on church news, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up for free through that website, tswyatt.com. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hi, it's Gavin.
I'm Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.